Okay. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for coming out. I know on all the inclement weather, it's not easy. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me pass these things out, please. Keep one for myself. So it's nice to see familiar faces. It's nice to see some new faces. Welcome, everybody. I believe that this series was by request, right? To pick women in Tanakh.
Well, it was women.
Women in general.
How did we phrase it?
Leora, were you? Not to put anyone on the spot.
It was women in Tanakh, but there was also it didn't have to specifically be Tanakh.
But I think we're cool with that.
Women are history, right?
Okay.
Women are history. There we go.
Jewish women.
So here we go. Here's the first Jewish woman. Here we go. We'll start with the first Jewish woman. So,
we're working on that.
Did everybody get the source sheets? Oh, there we go. Okay.
We're going to learn about Jewish mother's guilt and all the...
Everything in life is about Jewish mother's guilt. What's the joke? Behind every man stands a surprise mother-in-law. this series is sponsored by the Gerzberg family, so I want to thank them for that. It's very much appreciated. I guess we'll just jump right in. You know, these parshas that we're learning about, it's this week happens to be parshas Chayei Sarah, which deals with, ironically, it's called the life of Sarah, but it's her death. But for the last month or so, we've been spending time with Abraham and with Sarah. So I'd like to start back, and the first source is the end of parshas Noach, where we're very first introduced to Sarah. And the rule is, in learning the Torah, that we always look to see the first time a concept or person, an idea is mentioned. Rav Tzadok, the Vilna Gaon, and others explain the first time that something's mentioned, that's the source for it. And from there, once we understand it in its origin, we'll be able to extrapolate from there and to be able to apply it to other areas throughout. Like, for example, the first time the word Tov, good, is used in the Torah. So where is that found?
Creation,
right? So what's it referring to that's good? What is that? I heard a thing.
Light,
right? It says, light, God created light, and it was good. So fast forward to the beginning of Chumash Shmos, when the Torah tells us he sees little baby Moshe floating in the Nile, and he says that he's Tov, he's good. So what does the Medrash say that they saw that Moshe was good? Moshe was born was good. The whole house was filled with light, with Or. So there's a connection between the first time you find the word and how you're able to apply that throughout there. So with that, we'll start with, as you said, the first Jewish mother, Sarah Imenu. So let's find out how she's introduced to us. In the very first source, I'll read and translate. You have it in front of you. Vayikach Avram v'nachor lahem noshim, shem Eishes Avraham, Sarai. So the first thing we're mentioned is that she is the wife of Avraham. Her name was Sarai, with a yud, right? V'shem Eishes Nachor, Milka Bascharon, Avi Milka v'Avi Yiska. It was the father of this woman named Yiska. And then the next thing we're told is, Vatihi Sarai Akara, Ein Lo Vlad. So she's barren. So from the things I underlined, you see that the first three things that were told about her is that she's introduced to us as his wife. She's a wife. Her name is also Yiska. We'll talk about why that comes up right here. And also she's an Akara. She was barren. That's actually a theme that goes throughout the Imahos, the mothers, that they didn't have children. And the Gemara tells us the reason why they originally didn't have children, because Hashem desires their tefilos, so he put them in that very difficult situation in order to cause them to daven. That's a discussion unto itself, but I would like to just perhaps maybe we'll go in order. From the fact that we see that that her introduction to us is in connection with her husband. So we see from the beginning that Avraham and Sarah are not two separate people, that their destinies are linked. And it's the first Jewish mother, it's the first Jewish couple. But that's the idea, that a husband and wife are connected intrinsically. You know, we have sources that tell us that the Gemara tells us 40 days before a child is born, that a baskel, a heavenly voice, goes out and announces so-and-so who's going to marry so-and-so. It's already announced in Shemayim. The reason the Rebbe says not only is the announcement comes out, they even have like the place announced and who the caterer is going to be and all the flowers. We have the whole affair is taken care of already. It's announced who it's going to be. The second aspect is Yiska. So we'll discuss that, why her name is also called Yiska, that it's not a separate person, and why we're told immediately in our introduction to Sarah that her name is that. And we know actually her name is changed, right? Just that idea that both Avram and Sarah are linked. When Avram, his name is changed and added a hey. So Sarai's name is changed and she's added a hey as well. The two, again, go together. And finally, the fact that she's barren. This is the first thing that one of the first three things that we're told about her is that. So there's a commentary on the Torah called the Gur Ariyeh, the Maharal, and he discusses why it is that we see that first she's being given these titles, this information, why it comes at the very beginning. So you have here on the source sheet, it says, from Sar we learned that a woman has two missions in life. She has her individual mission from the time of her birth up till marriage, and the second is the joint mission with her husband from the time of her marriage. So it's a new shlichus, it's a new cause, a new mission as we have that begins at that point. So now, since Sara is being, we're told that she's the married, she's entering into the new phase of her life. Also interesting, Rashi pointed out on this is his commentary, I just have the English here, but I put you see the Hebrew because it's a play on words. Sarah, who we're familiar with, by the way, did anybody know that she also had the name Yiska? Mm-hmm. Yeah? You knew that was her. So the name is significant. Names are significant in the fact, if you look, Rashi tells us three different things that you can learn out from the name, and you see that you have a little bit of Hebrew, but it's explained. Rashi says, Yiska, this is Sarah. She's called Yiska because her beauty would socha. She would see with divine inspiration. So the first meaning of the word Yiska is the word derived from socha, that she was a prophetess. She was a Nevi'ah. She was one of a female prophetess. There were many throughout Jewish history. And that's the thing. If you notice, interestingly, if I would change the nekudot, if I would change the vowels, socha could also be read as sukkah. Okay, interesting. There's a lot to discuss about that, but I don't want to go too far off topic. I'm only going a little bit off topic tonight, not too far off topic. The second thing that her name is called Yissa because all gazed sochin to look at her beauty. The Gemara tells us, the Midrashim tells us, she was one of the most beautiful women who ever lived, ever. Usari Menu. And the third one, Yiska, is princedom, nesichut, that it's an expression of being of nobility. That Sara Imenu had all three characteristics to us. Number one, she was a prophetess. And we'll see that she was even on a higher level than Avraham, because Hashem tells Avraham to listen to what Sarah plans to do. She's on a higher level than you are. This is not apologetics. This is what it says in the traditional sources. We also know she was a very attractive woman. And it comes to an interesting point. When they're the story with Avram and Sarah, their travels together, they have to leave the land of Israel because there's a famine, and it's a very big test for them because they're told by God to go to the land, and it's the only land that has a famine. Everybody else, there was a lot of food to eat. In France, there was a lot of food. In Spain, in Uganda, there was a lot of food to eat. Only in Eretz Israel, there's no food to eat, so they have to leave and go down to Mitzrayim, to Egypt. And when he gets there, he says to her, please, Imri na achosiat, please tell everyone there that you are my sister. Sounds a little strange, right? Avram's gonna lie. Avram, the first Jew, he's gonna say something that's not true. It's deceptive. That's not the picture that I have in my mind of Avram. He's an Eilech Yid. He's an honest Jew. He's not gonna tell something like. So the Baal HaTanya has a beautiful explanation of that line. Again, Imri no, please say Achosi at, you're my sister. That first of all was not a lie because technically we would go through the whole family tree in the first source. We'd see that they were related. So I'm not bothered by that fact that technically it was true, they were a sister-type relationship. But says the Baal HaTanya something unbelievable. The Tanya tells us, he was the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Baal HaTanya, and he tells us that Avraham and Sarah are a paradigm. The love that exists between Avraham and Sarah was a lesson, a life lesson, really from our love towards God. And there's different types of love. There's a husband-wife type of love. And there's a brother-sister type of love. Different times in our life, our ups and downs, relate to Hashem using each of these two models of love. Now, each one has its benefits and each one has its disadvantages. The benefits of a brother-sister type of love is that you're born into it. It's constant. It's there. It's solid. It's stability. It's something you can count on. You have that family relationship. You didn't do anything to cause it. You were born into a family, brother and sister. Hopefully, they're there for each other. But that's the benefit is that it's constant. But on the other hand, that's what it is. It's stable. It's static. It doesn't change too much. The husband and wife model of relationship. So it wasn't always there, but when it kicks in, it's one of the most powerful loves that exists inside of a person. That bond that's created, it's not there from birth, but it's something new and it's something exciting. But because it's not so stable, it's not always been there, there's times it can fluctuate, it can go up and down. So on a deeper level, the message that Avram is saying to Sarah is we're going into a place of tremendous impurity, a society where they're immoral, where they're decadent. I'm going through a difficult time right now. So on a deeper level, when Avram turns to Sarah and says, Imri na achosi ati, he says, I want to change the type of relationship right now that I have with Hashem. Up until now, I've been focusing on God like a husband and wife. But again, it's dynamic, it's powerful, but it's not constant. I need to go back to a safe zone. I need to relate to Hashem as I'm going into this place, this Mokum tomb, this place of impurity. I need to relate to Hashem like a brother and sister. So when Avram is saying to his wife, Imri na achosi at, he's saying, I want to have that deeper relationship. Again, it's a symbolic interpretation of the text. He's explaining, I want to relate to Hashem right now in this place with consistency, like a brother and sister, with something that's solid, that something's always been there, something that's going to be a grasp for me to hold on to as I'm going into a deep place of spiritual danger. So that's one of the explanations that they says here, that they're, but their lives are together. So I want to continue with this idea about that Sarah was a nakara, that she was barren. By the way, this is like open questions. If I'm saying anything, you just, you know, this isn't class, you don't have to raise your hand, you just shout out. My tummy don't raise their hands either, everyone just shouts out. But you see that Sarah, like, she's strong and a self-confident woman. So look at the Rabbeinu Bechaya now, still on the first page. He's commenting on that last verse in the first source, right? Vatahi sar akrav ein lavlad. So she was barren, she had no child. So isn't that obvious? Mm-hmm. Right? And by the way, how many extra words are there in the Torah?
None.
So if the Torah is telling me that, by the way, not only she's barren, ein lavlad, what's the deeper meaning? So he says, Yesh noshim shokos zman meruba, shehin akaros va'achar kach yishlem bonim. There are many women who go through a very, very difficult time of infertility, but afterwards they have children. V'higir akosos, the Torah is telling us something. Shehaisa akara, she was barren, v'hosif, and it adds on, v'omra ein lavlad. It's telling us there's an additional thing. Besides the fact that she was barren, don't think that she was barren and that later on good news will come. Klomer she'ein beteva lihiyos lavlad l'oilam. She didn't have the biological, she didn't have a rechem, she didn't have a womb. According to the Rabbeinu Bechai, is based upon traditional sources, he's telling us that she was missing that part of her body. It was biologically impossible for Sarah Imena to ever have a child. So the Torah could have just stopped and said, Sarai was Akara, she was barren. Okay, so maybe keep davening, say Tehillim, go to fertility treatments, maybe it'll happen. No, Ein Lavlad, she didn't have the ability to do that. It's an unbelievable thing as we figure it out for ourselves. You know what the implications are? We're saying she's the first Jewish mother. So the first Jewish mother, motherhood begins in a place where the natural world ends. According to nature, according to all the x-rays, according to all the doctor's reports, it was physically impossible for Sarah to ever have a child. Yet we know Yitzchak comes into the world. According to all the laws of nature, there shouldn't be a Jewish people. We shouldn't be sitting here tonight on a rainy evening learning Torah together. You're right, according to statistics, that shouldn't happen. But Hashem runs the world. And if Hashem wants something to happen, it's going to happen. Even if according to statistics and doctors and surveys and Gornishman Helfen, it's going to happen. So that's what the Bein Mechai is adding to us. Now watch this. Let's go a step further. I'm still not at the end then. Valkein hiskimu shnehem. Therefore, the two of them agreed, says the Rabbein Bechaya, Avram v'Sarai, letzeis misham. They're going to leave their place where they were. Leches artza kanan. They're going to go to Eretz Yisrael, to Israel. Ulai b'zuchus ha'aretz ha'kadosha yivne sham. Maybe in the merit of going to such a holy place, the land of Israel, they'll be privileged. They'll have another mitzvah. Now they'll be able to have a family there. So then the Torah tells us now at the beginning of chapter 12, Vayomer Hashem al Avram lech lecha me'artzecha. Go, leave your homeland, leave your familiar background, leave your friends, leave your chevra, leave your fod, leave everything behind. Now to physically move is not so hard. It's annoying. You got to pack his box, little peanut like stuff things you got to do to get make sure the china doesn't break. So it's pretty annoying to pack up your dishes, but it could be done. The hardest thing in the world is to move somebody emotionally. To get out of a place, to be in one mind frame, and to put that all behind. It's kemat impossible. There's even psychological terms where they have something called the battered wife syndrome, right? You know what that is? Where a person could, God forbid, could be in an abusive relationship, and they can't leave. It's not even a thought that they'd ever stop and just get up. And any outsider looks at them and says, what are you doing? This is a horrible place you're at. You got to get out of here. I say, no, it's not so bad. So for Avraham, and what Sarah did also, they're a team, they left all bonds of familiarity. It's a scary thing. You know, we all know we have new things in our life. You know, a new job, a new community, a new school, something brand new happens. It's exciting, but it's nervous. What's it going to be like? They left every single thing behind to go to Eretz Yisrael. And they did this as a team. It's important to keep highlighting this over and over again, that Avram and Sarah were working together. Okay, let's turn to the next page for a minute. I want to go through, I know there's a lot to talk about, but I want to go through one of the interesting stories in the life, building upon this idea that she was in a car, she was unable to have kids. Excuse me, I've been talking all day, so I just need a little... Any questions? So Torah, I'll read it in English. This is chapter 16, Tezayin. Now Sarai, Avram's wife, had not born to him, as we saw, and she had an Egyptian handmaid named Hagar. And Sarai said to Avram, "Behold, now the Lord has restrained me from bearing. Please come to my handmaid. Perhaps I'll be built up from her." And Avram listened to Sarai's voice. Again, because she's on a higher level. So Sarai, Avram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her handmaid, at the end of 10 years of Avram's dwelling in the land of Canaan, and she gave her to Avram, her husband, for a wife. And he came to Hagar, and she conceived, and she saw that she was pregnant, and her mistress became unimportant in her eyes. So Hagar started looking down upon Sarai, and Rashi explains, we'll see it later on in the sources, but she thought like this: I was intimate with Avram once, and I became pregnant. Sarah's been with him so many years and she never got pregnant. It must be she's not as righteous as I am. It must be she's a faker. It must be it's all external. She puts up a good show, but she must not really be as holy as people think she is. Because after all, she didn't get pregnant and I did. So she started looking down upon Hagar. So Sarah said to Avram, "May my injustice be upon you. I gave my handmaid into your bosom and she saw that she became pregnant. I became unimportant in her eyes. May the Lord judge between me and you." And Avram said to Sarai, "Here is your hand in your hand. Do to her that which is proper in your eyes." Now this, the translation is interesting. They write it in the Hebrew, it says, "V'ta'aneha Sarai v'tivrach mipaneha." The translation here says, "Sarai humbled her, and she fled from before her." So the humbling is an interesting way of translating it. We'll see why it was important for Hagar to become, to feel that she was subservient to Sarai. There's a very important reason. This was not a cursory, superficial reading of the Torah would think that like Sarai had some big ego and she got upset because now she's better than I am. It's very important. It's not selfish at all, but it has to do with a very profound reason to why it had to be done in such a way that Hagar had to be underneath them. By the way, what's Hagar's background? Do you know where she came from? She came from Egypt, right? So when, as we said a minute or two ago, that when Avram and Sarai came down to Egypt, so Paro, the prince, the Egyptian leader, said, "Wow, what a special family this is. It's better that my daughter, who's a princess, it's better she be a shifcha, she be a maidservant with Avram, than she be a princess with another nation." So you see, that's how special this couple was, that Paro, the world power, sees how special, how unique they are, and says, "Look, my own daughter, I'd rather she be with them than be in the circles that I travel in." So here you have this Egyptian princess now being subjugated by Sarai, and her name itself, also as we saw from the Rashi, that the name itself of Yiska, of Sarai, represents nobility, that Sarai herself is a princess in the real sense of the term. So we'll move on to a little bit now and show you a few other things about this. There's a Medrash. And there's two opinions in the Medrash. I only put one of them on the source sheet for you. But Rabbi Yehuda Omer. Rabbi Yehuda says, "Lo with a vav, lo yalda." To him, lo with a vav means to him, to Avram, she didn't have any children. Il niseis la'acher yalda. But if Sarai would have been married to somebody else, she would have had a child. So that's kind of... We just said she doesn't have a vlad. How could she have a child with somebody else? That it seems to be, according to one opinion, there's others in the Medrash as well, but according to, here you have the translation, right? Rav Yehuda said, the Torah emphasized she had borne him no child. She bore no children to Avram, but she would have borne had she been married to another. So that's one opinion that again, how all the different Midrashim work together, but there's something unique about this. She didn't go elsewhere. And, we'll see in a minute, Avram didn't go elsewhere either until Sarah tells him to. So the loyalty that the couple had, even though they could have had children with others, they didn't want that. There was something unique about it. So now the Malbim, When did the Malbim live? In the 1800s. His commentary explains why was it that it came out through this order. So says the Malbim like this. It was God's plan that Yishmael be born before Yitzchak, and that he be born to Hagar rather than to Sarah. Like silver, from which all impurities are removed before it's put to the ultimate use, all but the holiest of spiritual forces had to remove from Avram before he could beget Yitzchak. And though Sarah could have given birth with another husband, she was restrained from conceiving with Avram until he had reached a state of complete spirituality. Therefore, Avraham married the Egyptian Hagar into Yishmael when any spiritual impurities that were in Avraham's makeup, thus purified in advanced age with any when any subtle negativity was clarified and birth could only be by heavenly gift, Avraham and Sarah produced Yitzchak. So you see in this the selfishness that she wanted to have a refined child. There's a lot to discuss in what this means. I'm going to try to use a question.
No, it's interesting because Hagar had Ishmael. Abraham wasn't circumcised yet.
Correct.
But
that's a very good point. It's true. And
so that barrier, that spiritual.
Correct. Barrier. Right. Very good. Excellent. I wasn't going to. Yes. You get an A. You pass.
Always does.
Yeah, it's true, right? You're my ringer. I plant you in the audience beforehand. I saw a beautiful article when my oldest daughter was preparing for her bas mitzvah. So my mother and her learned about Sari Menu. And one of the things they learned was this article from a woman named Hannah Weisberg. So she has an interesting idea. I want to kind of expand a little bit upon it. But she talks about the giving of both Avraham and Sarah, and the qualities that we can learn from them. So, she writes like this, that there are three ways you can react when you have an opportunity to give. The first thing you can say is no. I don't want to give. Yeah, a person asks you for a favor, they want to share something, you can say no, thank you, I'm not interested. The second thing is that you can give, but it's done with a little bit of a resentment. Like, you give, like, you know, I'm going to bake you a kugel, okay, but I wasn't too thrilled about it. But there's a third level. She writes, you give so wholeheartedly that you're not merely giving the gift, but you give a part of yourself. In fact, in the process, you actually give up your old self and transform yourself into something bigger and better. From a deeply moving episode in Sarah's life, we learn how to be selfless givers. So pause for a moment. Imagine what Sarah might have been thinking when she gives over Hagar to her husband. Did she? Yeah.
So that actually reminds me of something I heard about the Gematria and changing of the names, in that it was Abraham acquired Hay, but Sarai had to give up the Yud, and basically the Gematria is that's 10, and it split it in half, and 5 and 5 gave half of her Yud to Abraham and kept the other half. And so she, you know, Abraham added to himself, whereas Sarai changed herself and gave a piece of herself to Abraham.
Excellent. Very nice. Let me just explain. Can I just explain what gematria means? That every letter in the Hebrew alphabet has a numerical value to it. So when Abraham got his letter, he just got an addition, got an extra letter. He got 5 more points on his name. Sarai, so when her name had a yud, which is a numerical value of 10, but when she became Sarah, so she got subtracted. So you're explaining very nicely. No, it wasn't she was subtracted. 5 went to her, and 5 went to her husband. That idea of selfless, of giving to others. Beautiful. What's your name?
Allison.
Allison, welcome. All right, fantastic. Wow. Ricky, you packed the house tonight, don't you? So I'm going to continue the article a bit. Sarah needed to wait to give birth to Yitzchak until her husband experienced complete spiritual transformation. And so, restraining her emotions, restraining the natural repulsion that a woman would feel, Sarah selflessly told Avram to marry her maid. Sarah was aware that she and Avram were on a sacred, essential mission to spread the ideals of monotheism and morality to all mankind. This was a mission that was so innate and central to Sarah's life that she was willing to put aside her own feelings and sacrifice the intimacy of her married life to allow her husband to take her handmaid. Sarah realized that they would need someone who could continue the life's work after them. Only a child who was raised with their values, infused with their ideals, whom they could call their own, could successfully accomplish this. Originally, Hagar was an Egyptian princess, as we spoke this out, right? Her father, the Egyptian king, gifted her to Sarah as her personal handmaid. Hagar perceived Sarah's greatness and the loftiness of her way of life, and she preferred to become a maid in the home of Avram and Sarah rather than the life of royalty in the decadent Egyptian society. When Hagar became pregnant, however, she had a change of heart and became arrogant, openly disrespecting Sarah. Rashi explains Hagar's change of demeanor once she became pregnant. Her mistress was lowered in her esteem. Hagar would boast to the ladies who came to visit, "Sarah is not the same inwardly as she appears to be outwardly. She cannot be as righteous as she seems. For so many years passed without her having children, whereas I conceived after one union." At this point, Sarah needed to act, not to protect her ego, but to ensure the ideals that she sacrificed everything for would materialize. If Hagar would no longer defer to Sarah, there would be no chance of raising her child as Sarah's own, as Sarah had envisioned. In other words, the plan was that she's going to give Hagar a child, her husband, and they're going to have a child, but that child is the one who's going to come from Hagar and Avraham. That child's going to be the one who's going to continue Judaism. That's the kid that's going to have all the morality and all the philosophy and the approach to life that Sarah and Avram want the child to have. He's going to be the one. Biologically, he's not going to be her kid. But spiritually, it's her son. But once Hagar now no longer respects Sarah, so who says that she's going to let her child follow that path? If Hagar is thinking that she's better and holier and more righteous than Sarah, so then she calls the shots. So when it says that Sarah humbled her, it was to point out how crucial and essential was the success of this whole mission. This whole selfless act of her giving over her husband was for one purpose, that her husband would have a child. I wouldn't have any kids. Her husband would have a child to be able to give over Judaism to, monotheism. But if Hagar's not going to play nicely, then that ruins the whole plan. So Sarah had to. Hagar's child would not carry on Avraham and Sarah's vision, so traditions. So let's take a look at the situation from Avraham's perspective. We can imagine that as the years passed, Avram too longed for a child. Beyond his natural primal desire to be a father, he yearned to have a child to continue his life's work. As the years swiftly progressed, it became painstakingly clear that Avram would not have a child with Sarah. And yet, despite his obvious disappointment, at a time when it was common to have more than one wife or concubine, Avraham waited until Sarah herself suggested that he have a child with Hagar. Only at that point did he listen to the voice of Sarah. It wasn't coming from him. It was Sarah's idea. And it's more than that. It wasn't even that once Sarah said, okay, he takes her, he waits until Sarah physically, as we saw in the Pesukim, the verses say that Sarah gives Hagar to him. Rashi explains, Avram listened to the voice of Sarah, to the voice of prophecy. We said originally, when we're introduced to her, we have to know what woman we're talking about. We're talking about this beautiful woman. We're talking about she's the Ashes Avraham. The two are connected. And more than that, she is a prophetess. No doubt, Avram wanted a child of his own, but he realized what an act of self-sacrifice this was on Sarah's part and waited for her to initiate it. But there's more to learn from Avram's behavior. When an individual is being offered something extremely precious, he could accept it because he wants or needs it. Alternatively, he could take the gift not for his own sake, but for the sake of the giver. He realizes how huge the sacrifice is, but knows how important it is for her to be doing this. So at this level, it's a fascinating insight, she writes, the taker is not only a taker, but also a giver. He demonstrates how precious the individual is to him by not taking the gift for his own sake, but only for the sake of the giver. This was the deeply loving and giving relationship between Avram and Sarah. Even after Sarah suggests that Avram marry Hagar, Avram waited until Sarah actually, quote, took Hagar and gave her to him. So the Ramban says, the Torah doesn't simply say he did so. It emphasizes he listened, he heeded the voice of Sarah. This indicates that despite Avram's own deep longing for children, he acted only with Sarah's permission. And even now, his intention was not that he be built up from Hagar, that his offspring from her. He acted only to carry out Sarah's wishes that she be built up through Hagar, that she find satisfaction in her handmaid's children, or that she should merit her own children because of her unselfish act. Some of the commentators explain that she really was hoping that if she would have such an unbelievable act of Mesiris Nefesh, of sacrifice, and give over her handmaid, then Hashem would bless her with her own child afterwards. Some of the commentators explain that also. She concludes, from this trying episode in the life of Avraham and Sarah, we learn that the basis of a great relationship is selflessness and sensitivity. So what we learn from Sarah Main is that sometimes the act, we can become so selfless in our giving towards others. Right? Avraham teaches us the act of taking. Sometimes when a person takes, they can, through that act of receiving, they can actually be giving something to the one who was giving to them. Question? Yeah.
inside me, bothered by the whole thing, and it always has been, because other is a person. They're, you know, you're saying Sarah's giving it. I mean, it's like, she's a person, we wouldn't think of this as an ethical thing, you know?
From modern sensibilities, correct.
Right.
But in the ancient Middle East?
Well, yeah, but she's still a person. You shouldn't, we get upset that when Sarah and Abraham are traveling and they want to take her, why is it any different? You're taking somebody's servant. It's a person.
I agree with you, but from modern sensibilities, it's not necessarily...
Don't you think Hagar would want to be with, you know, have a child with Abraham? I mean, that's pretty, you know,
Yes, 100%. We even find with Hagar that we find later on that after Sarah dies, this week's parasha, so Abraham marries a woman named Keturah. Right?
They say it was Hagar.
And when one point one, that was Hagar herself. Why is she called Keturah? Right? There's an idea which we see called the conservation of biblical personalities. When you see people mentioned more than once, sometimes the rabbis will put together and point out, even though they have two different names, they're really the same person. So why is Hagar called Keturah? So Keturah comes from the word Keturis. Smells so sweet and beautiful like incense, and she was so faithful to them. So we see a high level of Hagar as a person herself. But again, in the ancient Middle East, this was quite kind. This was not to be considered abnormal at all. But just to kind of wrap it up a little bit, we see from Sarah this idea of selflessness and of true giving and a devotion to somebody, to something beyond oneself. So that's really, as we started by talking, that's the first Jewish mother. Jewish mothers have this quality. We believe that the Imahos, not only being historical, real people, that a piece of them gave over their spiritual DNA to inside of us. Right? That's why a convert to Judaism is allowed to say when we daven, Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoseinu, my God and the God of my ancestors, that we believe that you're part of them. Avraham and Sarah's whole life is about teaching and educating and bringing others closer to Hashem. And that's an idea that they extend with us. Maybe perhaps a take-home point from the class is, how do we view ourselves? Do we view ourselves more as takers, or do we view ourselves as being more givers? And is it possible that even when we are on the taking end, that we can do it in such a way that we actually give to the others? Just end with an idea that Rabbi Yudin once suggested. You know, sometimes you have guests in your home for Shabbos, and they say, can I help? Right, you know, all the food's cooked already, all the beds are made, everything's done. Can I help? Can I do anything? You want to give them something. They're asking, I want to help, but there's really nothing to do. Yeah, you could help, maybe sweep the floor. Do you really need your guests to sweep the floor? No. But in that act of taking, you're really giving them something. Because they want to help. They want to. Many people, they get past the surface level. Many people want to give. They want to get more involved. They want to grow. But we don't create opportunities for them. Perhaps we think about the lessons of Sarah and Avraham, is that there's ways to become takers, but in that act of taking, we can actually give to the person as well. Thank you, everybody, for coming. And I really appreciate everyone coming out, especially with this horrible weather. But all right. Baruch Hashem. Mirtz Hashem. Looking forward to see everybody next time.
Thank you.
Okay. Have a good night.